KALW.
You know, the police department is not the solution for everything, but I do believe that the number one job of our government is to keep our residents safe.
Candidates running for mayor of San Francisco are ramping up their campaigns.
I am running for mayor because I believe experience and competence matters.
Today, we hear from Mark Farrell, former San Francisco District 2 supervisor. Then a chef from Guyana honors his grandma through his restaurant.
She told me that even after I'm gone, I will still be protecting you.
A trip to Pleasanton to visit with Chef Maurice. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Our friends at KALW's show State of the Bay have been talking to candidates running for mayor of San Francisco this year to find out why they think they should take the top job at City Hall. Over the next few weeks, we'll be sharing parts of those conversations here on Cross Currents. First up, candidate Mark Farrell. He grew up in San Francisco. He's worked as a lawyer and a venture capitalist. In 2010, he was elected to the Board of Supervisors. He served two terms representing District 2. Then, after San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee died unexpectedly in 2017, the board appointed Farrell to serve as mayor for 6 months of his remaining term. Now, he's running to serve a full term. Here's the host of State of the Bay, Grace Wan, in conversation with Farrell.
The center of your campaign is public safety, and that's something that concerns a lot of San Francisco citizens. The statistics say that San Francisco is safe. Murder rates are low, some of the lowest they've ever been. But you say people don't feel safe and that we need to fire the police chief, Bill Scott. Why is that?
Look, Chief Scott is a good man, and this is one of a number of points that I make about our police department and public safety in general. The reality is the average tenure of a police chief in the United States is 3 years, and Chief Scott has been here for close to eight. And I firmly believe, in talking with officers throughout the rank and file of our police department, that we need a new injection of leadership to provide inspiration for the rank and file, and to really kind of take on the next step in what's going to be the evolution of our police department here in San Francisco.
Well, you chaired the budget committee for many years when you're on the Board of Supervisors, mm-hmm. and San Francisco is facing a significant deficit, something in the hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm curious, from your perspective, what does a reasonable investment in public safety look like?
Well, to be quite frank, it's really a complete change in direction from what we've seen over the last 6 years under this mayor. You know, when I was chair of our budget committee for 4 years, end up being the longest serving budget chair in our city's history, and partner with Mayor Lee. And then when he did pass away, unfortunately, and I became mayor in 2018, we grew our police department every single year. To the tune of, when I left office in 2018, there were over 2,350 police officers in our department. And since then, we have lost over 600 police officers. So more than 25% of our police department is gone. And to me, that's simply not putting the public safety of our residents first. That's turning, whether it be willful or not, a blind eye to our staffing levels and how that affects San Francisco residents. And I believe we need to change direction.
So much has happened, though, since you left office in 2018. We had COVID, we had George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement that really put police across the country under the spotlight. So is Chief Scott to blame for that?
Oh, look, not at all. I'm not blaming Chief Scott for anything here. For me, this is about, you know, really taking an honest look at our police department, the tenure of our police chief at this point in time, and saying that we need new leadership. We need a different type of enthusiasm. We need a police chief right now that is going to fight for additional budget dollars, a police chief that will fight for additional personnel, and simply won't take direction from our police commission. You know, the reality is 2 years ago, our current mayor stripped $120 million, or approximately 20% of our police department budget, out of our police department. And this year is asking for another 10% budget cuts across the board because of all of the fiscal mismanagement that is happening. To me, that is not prioritizing public safety. And that's not putting San Francisco residents first. And look, you know, the police department is not the solution for everything, but I do believe that the number one job of our government is to keep our residents safe. We haven't done that. We've gotten to the point where we're at record low police staffing levels. And again, we need to change direction and put the safety of our residents first.
You know, what we've seen a lot in the last couple of years in terms of city government is there's a lot of finger pointing. The DA might blame the police for not arresting people. The police blame the DA for not bringing their arrests to cases. The mayor blames the police and the this and the that. I mean, there's just a lot of finger pointing. So if you're a mayor, will the buck stop with you? Will you take responsibility?
Look, 100%. And in my opinion, that is the one thing we've sorely lacked over the past 6 years is true leadership in City Hall. All we hear is a litany of excuses from we can't do anything because of the Board of Supervisors or a commission or pick another entity that you want to blame, as opposed to saying, you know what, I'm the leader of our city government. Here's my vision for the city of San Francisco. Here's the roadmap on how I'll get there. Hold me accountable. And we certainly have no vision coming out of City Hall right now about the future of San Francisco. And we certainly don't have any accountability and leadership or people willing to take accountability. I believe that's a key element of having residents trust in our city government to be willing to be held accountable and not blame everybody else. I will handle it completely differently as mayor.
Well, would you say that Mayor Breed has no vision? I mean, she's put forward efforts to try to streamline the housing and getting permits through. She's tried to revive downtown. She's trying to bring in, you know, more policing on the streets and through cameras. I mean, is that no vision?
Well, I challenge each one of those aspects. You know, 2 years ago, she took $120 million out of our police department budget. Now, because it's more politically expedient, choosing to, you know, at least publicly proclaim that she's pro-police, to me, that's flip-flopping at its worst. You know, in terms of investing downtown, there has never been a mayor in modern history that has overseen a steeper decline in our downtown corridor from an economy perspective than this mayor. You know, our vacancy rate is higher than any other major U.S. city right in the United States. It's tragic what's become of our local economy. And I simply don't believe that either there's been intention or if there has been, it's simply a failure of policy at the end of the day. The results speak for themselves, unfortunately.
You did ask for an armed California National Guard to help with the fentanyl state of emergency, to implement a bold recovery plan to save lives and close open air drug markets. So one of your plans is to bring in the National Guard, right?
But the reality is we need in the Tenderloin additional law enforcement personnel to help because our own police department has been so depleted under this administration. Again, we have lost over 25% of our police department in the last 6 years since I left office. I mean, there's no wonder that public safety is the number one concern of San Francisco residents right now. But because of that, the biggest impact is in our district stations throughout San Francisco. And the amazing men and women that we have and the amazing police officers that we have manning those stations, simply there are not enough of them to honestly keep our residents safe, let alone in one of these hotspots like the Tenderloin District. So we need to appeal to our state and we need to appeal to our federal government for help. And that's both financial help, but it's also law enforcement help. It is literally impossible to think and ignorant to think that you're going to solve the drug crisis, the drug dealing, and the drug addiction issues that have resulted from that in the Tenderloin without law enforcement.
I want to get to another question from a listener. And one of the things you're facing is you are in a large group of somewhat moderate candidates. And this email from Matt, he writes, your profession of venture capitalist has a perception of being one that serves wealthy interests with the objective of maximizing return on investment. Money is the master, not serving the people or protecting the planet. Why would somebody who chose that profession make a good public servant?
Oh, great question. Well, so first of all, I would challenge that characterization. And obviously, like any profession, you know, people approach it differently and handle things differently. What I would suggest is that, you know, I am running for mayor because I believe experience and competence matters. You know, what I am able to bring to the table as a candidate is 7.5 years of effective leadership inside of City Hall, representing District 2 on the Board of Supervisors. Again, I was the longest serving budget chair in our city's history, and then became mayor in 2018. All the priorities that I believe were relevant then are relevant now for the city of San Francisco, and had great success. But also, I'm the only candidate in this race that has ever held a single job in the private sector. You mentioned my professional background before, but it was an attorney, an investment banker, and then an investor, you know, for the last 14 years. I believe that given our city's current financial crisis and our fiscal picture over the next 5 years, there's a projected budget deficit of $1.5 billion. I believe now more than ever, it is critically important to have somebody come in with a finance background that can lead the budget process in City Hall, that can lead with a vision and a set of priorities that he or she will fund fully, and be able to balance the budget while doing so. That's what I can offer to the residents of San Francisco. And that's why I believe that I am the best person to lead our city forward for the next 4 years.
That was San Francisco mayoral candidate Mark Farrell speaking with State of the Bay's host, Grace Wan. Next week, we'll be hearing from candidate Asha Safai. And you can catch State of the Bay on KALW tonight at 6 for more conversations with local leaders, artists, authors, and more. Tonight, host Ethan Alkine speaks with Tommy Orange. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Moving to the U.S. from another country is a big life change. Whether you're fleeing persecution or you just want a better life, the personal stories of immigrant and diaspora populations are important to hear and understand. I'm a daughter of immigrants, and I'm always fascinated by the stories of others with similar life stories. That's why I'm starting a new series of interviews called Diaspora Stories. I'll be sitting down with people who've made the Bay Area their home and are doing the thing they love. We'll hear why they do what they do and their personal journeys to get to where they are now. We start in the East Bay, in downtown Pleasanton, where you'll find a lot of restaurants lining Main Street. And then there's Oyo. Oyo is an Afro-South American restaurant, and the founding chef, Maurice Dissels, came from his home country of Guyana when he was 17. He grew up in his grandma Oyo's kitchen, and he serves dishes he learned from her. Her ancestors were brought over from West Africa to Guyana in the transatlantic slave trade. And Grandma Oyo had this cooking philosophy called muxalace. It means, let's lace this pot up with a little bit of everything. That's what Chef Maurice does at Oyo. He mixes his Afro-Guyanese influence with flavors from South America and the Caribbean. I visited Chef Maurice at the restaurant to hear how it all came together and how Grandma Oyo is ever present in his life.
You know, growing up in a household with 10 brothers and sisters and extended family with cousins and aunts and uncles, you know, I, at an early age, really gravitated towards my grandmother and helping her in the kitchen, you know.
What would you do?
I would do all sorts of things, mainly plucking chickens, helping her portion, for instance, when we slaughtered a pig or a lamb, I would help her process it.
Would you help slaughter it? Do you know how to slaughter?
Most definitely. Started at an early age. You know, my grandmother believed in, we had a ritual that we calmed the animal, thanked the animal before the slaughter for the sustenance that it was about to deliver to us. So we went through this whole ritual. We had fish ponds. We had extensive gardens, vegetable gardens.
What vegetables?
We grew everything from ground provisions, cassava, edos, potatoes, yams, sweet potatoes, squashes, zucchinis, above ground.
So the land over there is good for that, those. What about fruits?
Oh, a lot of, well, fruits are indigenous. Fruits are, I don't think we, as a nation, we no longer have to plant fruit trees. They're everywhere. If you walk home from school, which we often do, star fruit lines the street, mangoes, bananas, you know, wild berries.
Can you tell me about Grandma Oyo? I'm looking up at a painting of her on your wall here at the restaurant.
Yeah. Well, Grandma was the matriarch of the family. And she controlled everything in and around the home. My grandmother's station was really the kitchen. A miracle worker. Oftentimes when we would be concerned because we see the pantry is pretty much bare. No, you know, I'm not seeing any money or, you know, the paycheck hasn't come in or my mom's allowance was not sent from the United States. My mom was here. You know, we would ask, hey, what's for dinner? What's for... She's going, don't worry about it. Today's dinner or breakfast is going to be a muxales. What's a muxales, we ask? Oh, that's when she goes back in the pantry, in the fridge, whatever is in there, she's going to come up with a dish. And oftentimes that dish is like, and that's my grandmother's muxales. And so in Guyana, during my my middle school and high school, I also enrolled in culinary classes at one of the institute on a part-time basis that furthered my passion for cooking and just learning, you know, the science and the chemistry behind it. So I always knew that that was my love, my passion, and that's what I wanted to do. So when I came to the United States...
What is it about cooking that draws you so much?
Well, I think the chemistry, the science about it. I remember I was always fascinated by my grandmother when she would combine a set of ingredients and then it turned into something. Like, for instance, that she would put butter, mix it, you know, with water, fluff it up, put eggs and flour, and then all of a sudden we got this beautiful pancake. Or she would put these meats and vegetables and we got this braised pepper pot, you know?
Today you have this beautiful restaurant, but what was it like at the beginning before this restaurant?
I came here when I was 17. Attended school in Chicago. I worked as a dishwasher in a food service. And then during college, I worked in a more established restaurant as a prep cook. I really loved it. I excelled both, you know, at school in the culinary arts. After college, I applied for a mentorship under a great professional chef in Chicago, worked under his tutelage for about 5 years, and then I'd risen to the level of assistant chef, moved to California. Once I got here, I realized the culinary scene was really sky's the limit, and so started my journey. But I've always known that my ethnic cuisine was fantastic. I've always known that. And so I started to really think about this. I want to do Guyanese cuisine. The only challenge was left for us was how do we present it? Because in a fine dining establishment, people wouldn't understand it.
Yeah.
Not everyone anyway, right? And so our challenge now that we set out to take these wonderful, yummy dishes and come up with some very creative and imaginative presentation.
I totally know where you're coming from. When you're coming from a different country, a different culture, and your food is very different, and the way you eat your food is very different, and the ingredients are different than, you know, what I would say most Americans are used to, it feels like a risk that you're taking, and you took that risk. How did you start thinking about the menu, and what did you want to include? What did you say? Oh, I have to have this. I got to have this. How did that come about?
You make an interesting point there. The cuisine being different. I knew that Pleasanton, it's a meat and potatoes community. We love our meat and potato. We lean towards things like the braised short rib, which is a classic Guyanese dish. It's a Christmas dish. It's mainly prepared during the holiday season. It's called pepper pot.
Oyo pepper pot.
Oyo pepper pot, mm-hmm. Right? So again, that's meat. We went with oxtail, a very popular South American consumed meat item. It's popular in Jamaica. It's popular in Trinidad. It's popular in Guyana. It's popular in Suriname. It's popular in Grenada. We had a lot of bases covered with our oxtail, right? The jerk chicken, of course. Folks, not only in Pleasanton, but around the U.S., are well-traveled. People have vacationed in Jamaica. And what can they tell you that was really yummy? We had the jerk chicken, all that. For the first time, that was so good. Then we augmented it with like some really whimsical tapas-style things like the street food doubles. It's a Trinidadian street food. At every corner, you will have people selling these doubles. They call it a barra pocket. It's a dough that's fried. It likens that to like a tortilla or a pita bread in texture. Then a garbanzo stew is made with some rich spices of cumin and curry and turmeric, herbs, spices, onions, garlic, to make a garbanzo stew. That then is plunked down onto the para pocket. And then you would squeeze some chutneys in there, like mango chutney, tamarind chutney, some roasted coconut, some cucumber relish, right? And then if you wanted to, you can put shrimp or chicken. And then you just fold it like a tortilla. Like a, you know, and you would eat it. It typically comes in some baker's paper or something, and you walk down the street. You see the really wonderful dish, right?
Okay, well, I've been here many times, and the one thing that I think me, my friends, my family appreciated was just the flavors that come out with one dish. One dish can have savory and sweet and tangy, and you feel all of those. That's purposeful, isn't it?
That's driven really by what's abundant in our country. We got abundance of ginger, cinnamon, and nutmeg, and allspice. Those are all things that grow. Mint, and you know, yeah.
And the pickles for the table. Can I just say, I'm a pickle person, and I think I come from so far away from here, you know, in Africa, but the flavors remind me of home so much, especially eating with something. Like, it's not just the dish, it's pickles with the dish. So condiments are big.
Yes, condiments are big. For us, it's about layering the dish. Some marriages are made in heaven, right? A little bit of this, add to a little bit of that. Like, for instance, like if you took the pickles, right? Typically, pickles are vinegar, sugar, and salt, right? But here, what we did, we added star anise. We added cinnamon sticks. We added clove, cardamom.
12:45, this place is starting to be popping, and people are starting to definitely come in. I don't want to take you away for too much. But I want you to kind of look around and just, you know, reflect on your journey, what it means to you that you are now here in this place, able to pay tribute to your origins, to Guyana, to your food, to your grandma who is with us here on this wall.
One of the great satisfactions I get from running this establishment is representing my native cuisine. When Guyanese people come here, they express gratitude and they're so proud to show Guyana, even as a small sliver, in a positive light.
When you walk across the restaurant, you have to see her because she's taking up a whole wall.
When we had the idea to open up the restaurant, you know, I was asked by relatives, what will you name the restaurant? I said, Oyo, of course. But my grandmother passed away about 25 years ago. I think I was about 21. Of course, you know, that was a great loss. But, you know, my grandmother always told me when I was young, she told me one thing that I never forget. Even after I'm gone, I will still be watching over you. Actually, she said, I'll be protecting you. And, you know, at times when I find myself in challenging times, even today, I would silence myself and then I would ask her counsel, you know? I would ask for guidance from her, still to this day. Sun is shining,
the weather is sweet. That's Chef Maurice Dissels of Oyo Restaurant in downtown Pleasanton. His story is part of our series, Diaspora Stories. And if you want to see Chef Maurice and his grandma, we've got photos at klw.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Sarah Jesse, Lina Nagia Basuni, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Molly Blair Salier, Victor Tense, Shireen Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Dawood Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanout Baba. A new day is rising.